Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Craig Calhoun, who is president of the Social Science Research Council. He also holds the title of University Professor of the Social Sciences at New York University and is the founding director of NYU's Institute for Public Knowledge. Professor Calhoun, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in Watseka, Illinois, which is a little tiny town downstate where my father had a, well, it was the big town near Cisna Park, Illinois, where my father had a church. And he was a Protestant minister, and we moved many times while I was a kid. So I can't give any single answer to where I was raised. I spent the longest periods in Kentucky and in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
It was obviously their plan that I would become a fieldwork-oriented social scientist because they kept dropping me into these new circumstances, new schools where I had to meet people, I had to figure out how things were going on, how the community worked, and their plan turned out successful. That's what I do for a living.
What was the conversation like at the dinner table? What did you talk a lot about social activism and or history or politics or what?
History more than either social activism or politics, though some of each. My father was an evangelical Christian minister, though of a relatively liberal bent as that went, and very interested in history. So we talked lots about all manners of mainly Western history and to some extent religion and church history and the Bible. And so, you know, I remember conversations about the Protestant Reformation when I was a small child, and as he was trying to explain to me why that happened and what church unity meant. He was very invested in the idea that there should be reconciliation and ecumenical unity among churches. And so this became one of the themes. What are the Methodists like and why aren't we like the Methodists and various different versions of that?
So you're already making distinctions and looking at social issues in a broader context.
Yes. And then, of course, I grew up during the time of the Civil Rights Movement and that was certainly an issue not just in family but in school as schools became integrated and different things changed and all of that with family connections. My uncle, also a minister in the same church as my father, marched at Selma, and that was sort of an issue. And my father was sort of sympathetic but not an activist, and that was, you know, what was different about their different stances, but certainly of interest. My father had a blow up in a church when he tried to hire a black associate pastor at one point. This is after we had moved. This is in Orange County, California, which is the kind of place that sounds like it might have that sort of blow up. And so this was the era shaped it, right, from the Civil Rights Movement into the peace movement in the 60s. The disappearance of a sort of consensual, loosely liberal Christian position into a variety of contending positions.
Mm-hmm. And then where did you do your undergraduate and graduate work?
Well, I preserved the habit of moving around. I started at the University of Southern California with an interest in film, and I got interested in anthropology through ethnographic film. Mm-hmm. And so I was there for 3 years. I then went to Princeton. I got drafted. I did alternate service working in a prison education program in New York, and during which time I finished the remaining classes for a BA and then did a master's degree at Columbia University and stayed on at Columbia in graduate school for a while, then went to Manchester University in anthropology. Suffered the loss that my advisor, Max Gluckman, died during my first year there. I followed another faculty member to Oxford, did my doctorate there.
Mm-hmm. And what was your research on?
My research was on the workers' movements of the late 18th and especially early 19th century in England, informed by an interest in trying to put the perspectives from anthropological and other social science studies in the developing world, contemporary studies of what the transition from into an industrial society was like, to work trying to understand the disruptions and the solidarities of the Industrial Revolution era.
And I think I read somewhere that you make the point that although you've been hired as a sociologist, that's not what you weren't trained as a sociologist.
No.
You were trained in social relations.
Well, that was Harvard. But I had certainly some education in sociology. And at Columbia, I did a lot of work in it. But my degrees are in anthropology and history.
Uh-huh.
And so the bridge between economic and social history, there was a social history boom in a way going on during the 1970s when I was in graduate school, and I was very much shaped by that social history boom. There were stronger connections to anthropology than to sociology in Britain. There were a lot of connections in the U.S. to sociology in this, mm-hmm. and they would grow later.
So fitting for your current position, your work has truly been interdisciplinary.
Yes, and you can make up your own mind whether I'm a dilettante or an interdisciplinary figure, but I've been engaged with the full range of social scientists. I've published in psychology journals. I've been, interested in economic issues. So if it does seem like I was sort of destined for something like the SSRC.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a way, is it fair to characterize your work that you're interested in popular politics, social movements, protest, and many other things?
Yes, that's absolutely fair.
Right. Now, I want to focus briefly before we talk about doing social science on a book that you wrote on Tiananmen called Neither Gods Nor Emperors, which I will show our audience.
And, good, because it's my photograph.
Good. Well, it's a very good book, so people should buy it for more than the photograph. Tell us about how that book came to be. You were in China teaching, and for somebody who's interested in social movements, there was run right out the door.
Well, exactly. I went to China to teach during the spring semester of 1989, splitting an annual position. The Marshall Solins from the University of Chicago, an anthropologist, went in the fall to teach other half of the year in the same position, and sort of grumbled ever since that he made all this possible, but I got to see all the action. The movement was, of course, brewing and had in some ways been brewing for a considerable period of time, and especially since January, but it really took off in April. And so I knew a variety of students who had come to my classes and that had been a part of the university world there, and followed the students into and through the protests. And the chance for somebody who had been mainly a historical researcher to look at and participate to some extent in very contemporary ways in a major protest, and one where some of the scripts had historical reference, was fun. I mean, students actually sat on barricades and say, "This is like 1848, isn't it? Do you think there will be an 18th Brumaire?" And because of course they had all read the Marxist texts.
Right. And did it in a way, and when one looks at the book, you bring a unique perspective because you're not a person who studies China as your main
That's right.
vocation. Right.
That's right. I had been in China before, and I spoke a little bit of Chinese, but better suited to getting a taxi to go where I wanted to go than to having a political conversation. So I would never pretend to be a sinologist. I tried to do my homework, benefiting from the work of sinologists as well as from the research I'd done with students and the interviews and the participant observation and all. And I think there's actually too little of that. I think that too seldom really strong area-based knowledge is used in systematic, detailed ways by people who aren't area studies specialists. There's sort of a divide. And so you have to be a member of the area studies fraternity, or then you go do some other kind of work. And it seems to me there ought to be much closer bridges. But in any case, I had spent the summer of 1984 in China. I had some background in this, and I'd been interested in China as a student, but I'd never really prepared in a serious way as a sinologist. Mm-hmm. Perspective that I was able to bring to it, aside from that of participant observation and trying to look at all the documents and interview as many people as I could, was that of a comparative researcher. Mm-hmm. On social movements and on related issues, thinking about how this fit into patterns that might be observed more generally.
And in the end, you wind up really seeing the importance of culture, basically, and how ideas in a very turbulent time of change came to a affect the way people saw themselves and who they thought they were and what position they held in society and really national identity, too. How do you reshape national identity?
Right, both of those. I think that in terms of organization, one of my emphases is on the importance of pre-existing social ties, that, for example, students are already organized in classes and have networks and have campus-based groups, and that this social organizational basis made it possible to mobilize, and then they were able to connect to some other groups in society. But what gave the intellectual character to the protest, what gave it its ideological message and its slogans and so forth, was a combination of thinking about the possible development of China, how it might become a stronger, more successful, more modern country, and the place of intellectuals, as the students aspired to be, in that development. Mm-hmm. And so these come together around questions of what kind of nation will this be, how to become strong, and those had old historical reference back to the May 4th movement in 1919, where we just had an anniversary. The slogan of science and democracy is a slogan that was current then and had continued resonance for these students, because the idea that people of knowledge had a special role to play in building a more participatory modern democratic society was key.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, and I think a point you're emphasizing, is that it wasn't students looking after their own interest. And that's the story. In fact, in the course of participating, their identities changed, and they were really concerned about the nation and were therefore able to mobilize different sectors
absolutely.
Of the society.
So I think that's absolutely right in at two senses. One, that just individually, the students' sense of who they were and what they stood for wasn't something fixed in advance. They said, well, these are my material interests. I want to be able to have higher job security and better wages when I get out or something. They were able to shift, and they were shaped by what they participated in. But also, they had selfish interests, as everybody does, but they were able to transcend these enough mm-hmm. that the message could speak to other groups in society and speak about Chinese society. And I think, in fact, the movement was more nationalist than much of its international press play. One of the ways in which the students were sophisticated was to talk about democracy in English and to talk about strengthening the Chinese nation in Chinese some of the time, appealing to different constituencies. And they didn't see these as contradictory, but they were different emphases.
Mm-hmm. Let's go from here to talking about social science. And I think students are always interested in knowing, you know, what is the skill set do you see as necessary to do social science well, no matter what discipline you're in?
All right. Well, there's no one answer at the level of methodology or something, but let me answer with reference to the China book. The mm-hmm. primary thing that makes a good social scientist is being interested in the social world and paying attention to it. So if you are somebody whose specialization in a particular skill set makes you not pay attention to what's going on in the world, including what's going on in long-term historical change, as well as what's going on today in the news, you're going to be a less effective social scientist. You're going to be less likely to challenge some of the categories of received wisdom. You're going to be less likely to speak to the big issues. So my sense is that a social scientist really needs to bring an engagement with what's going on in the world to his or her work. And that's as true if they're doing archaeology of Mesoamerica as if they're doing contemporary political science. It obviously takes different forms and reflects it in different ways. But if you don't have a sense of aware, observing engagement, you're not going to have very much imagination when it comes to thinking about what a way of life might be in one context, or why it might change, and how it might feel to people as it begins to change, and when would they turn to protest, or when would they become militant defenders of the existing order.
Mm-hmm. Now, there seems to be a contradiction here in the sense, one is some of these skills sound like those of a journalist, that is, in the sense of being aware of what's going on in the world. On the other hand, the social sciences model themselves on the sciences, where the focus is on the community of other scientists, where is the discipline, and so on. How do you navigate that tension?
Well, let me suggest it's even more complicated. So the social scientists, I think, are split and pulled three ways. And sometimes that means there are three different camps, but it just means different pulls on individuals, too. One of those pulls is indeed towards the idea of scientific method and strengthening a research base of highly secure, highly reliable knowledge and theory to interpret that, the more factual side of that knowledge. And so there is a pull towards that. And you can say that, well, an extreme of that is looking at the way in which psychology has moved into the neurosciences or economics, high mathematicization. And that's certainly driven by a desire to be scientific. The second side to social science, though, is an engagement with the social world. And this has been true throughout the history of modern social sciences. You can't think of someone like Adam Smith or the figures of the Scottish Enlightenment, Hobbes or Locke or any of these figures as merely ivory tower intellectuals. And that continues on through to great figures today. So the attempt to connect serious, rigorous scientific knowledge to broader public issues is different from simply being a journalist reporting what's going on. There may be very sophisticated, much more theoretically knowledgeable journalists, but in general, the task of the social scientist is to bring strong, rigorous knowledge to looking at those contemporary issues. And it's a collective task. So some people may specialize in archival research or quantitative research methods and others in helping to do the translational work. That's a different question. But collectively, they're doing it. But there's a third bit, and that's the connection of the humanities. The social sciences grow in very significant part out of the humanities. They don't grow out of the sciences. They grow alongside the sciences, shaped by it. In many ways, sociology, political science, economics all grow out of history and out of broad public engagements and social reform during the 19th century. So on the one hand, you have that pull towards the social issues and social reform. How do we run welfare systems better? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have an attempt to grasp different ways of life in different times, to grasp enduring values, ideas of the virtues, the classics, a historical grounding, an idea that you can't understand the present if you don't know the past, you can't understand this place if you don't know other places. And I think that humanistic side to social science is also an important pull, so that really what goes on in the social sciences is shaped by these three different pulls: to present contemporary engagements, to scientific rigor, and to humanistic awareness of a broader range of values, understandings, ways of life.
And in that context, where does innovation and creativity come from? Is it, in your view, balancing all three of these balls together simultaneously?
That's certainly a good thing. I don't know if it's the distinctive source of innovation. I think there's innovation in each of these three different lines of work. I've been particularly impressed with how much innovation is driven by a contemporary problem-solving engagement. You know, how are we going to deal with this? Well, we're worried. You know, my generation, the Vietnam War, led people to look at social conflict in other contexts as well, to ask whether war was inevitable or whether long-term peace could be built, to ask whether the national structure of relations among nation states was natural to the world or was an artificial creation that could be transformed into a global cosmopolitan social order or something like this. The engagement in contemporary affairs, it doesn't mean that you just report on the contemporary, but I think it does lead to innovation because it leads people to go back and look at other cases with different eyeglasses on, different comparative perspectives. In a similar sense, I think international work leads to innovation because it leads to seeing that there is variation that needs to be explained, and it undercuts the tendency sometimes to think that there's an inevitable character to any one case. It just had to be the way it was, to put it alongside others. So I think innovation comes from crossing these different methods, but not necessarily just balancing them all. It's often getting an enthusiasm from one place and then taking it with careful, rigorous work to another topic.
Now, if we're talking about the character of an excellent social scientist, that is, so what are the human virtues that you see necessary to be able to do this?
Well, fortunately, I think that the answer is a plurality, as there are a bunch of different ways to be a good social scientist. And we sometimes try to extol one model and we say, okay, it is going to be all about the development of mathematical laws. Therefore, it's going to take rigorous training in applied mathematics. And then it's just going to be focusing in and the capacity to ignore those things that you can't put into your model. Well, there's a niche for that, but that's not the whole story. At the same time, you wouldn't want the whole story to be any one other model. So I think that what it takes to be a good social scientist is a capacity to become really deep along one line of research and stay in touch with and connected to others who are pursuing different lines of research, often by different methods or with different cases in mind. So when you asked me about China, for example, I'm not a sinologist. I won't pretend that I have that kind of training. But it seems to me that we don't want only sinologists thinking about China. We want other people with other foci and interests to also engage with, try to understand China, trying to fit it into a global picture. And that's true, I think, across all the methods. So if there's a neglected element to social science training, it's the ability to situate the tools and the passions and the focus that enable you to become deep in relationship to a wide range of other lines of work.
Mm-hmm. Before we talk about the Social Science Research Council and your agenda there, let's talk briefly about the university. I read a piece that you wrote, I think it was a review of a book, and you were, I would say, critical of where the university has arrived as a conglomerate, you know, emphasizing research and so on. And so I'm interested in talking a little about that because, as your book on China shows, you have to look at the environment and kind of so if social scientists are going to think about what they have to do, they have to know what social science has become in the context of the university. Talk a little
right, and I think social scientists are insufficiently reflexive about this. We don't pay enough attention to the institutional bases of our own work, how they shape us, but also how they make it possible to do what we do. The university is a very important social institution, probably studied less than it ought to be just on almost any grounds, like how much money society invests in it or how it is important to society. So there isn't as thriving and as good a sociology of higher education, a political science of the universities, and economics of knowledge as there ought to be, because these are very big social issues. And I would like to see more of that. I am critical and worried. And I'd say at first in somewhat material terms that I think universities grew like conglomerate corporations, did not go through a major structural adjustment in which there was a lot of thinking about where is the center of gravity and what's the key focus, but instead kept dealing with shifting economic environments, often by adding new units so that they are enormously complex. And we have become relatively poor at articulating what it is the university stands for, either to ourselves as a value in trying to organize it better in focus, or to the broader public. Mm-hmm. And that sets us up, I think, for a lot of problems. And in sharp economic crises, some of those problems come more to the fore. But they come in new demands for accountability from outside. They become in new questions asked by freshmen and their families. And there are a lot of ways. The costs of research are one piece of this, not the only one. We have a very peculiar science policy in this country, which suggests that the parents of undergraduates should pay a large part of the cost of new knowledge creation and research.
And that has just happened. I mean, it's not as if
nobody sat down and said, let's do it that way.
Yeah.
Right. They sat down and said, let's create the National Science Foundation. Let's create the National Institutes of Health. They sat down and said, let's have the California Master Plan. Right. There are a variety of planning efforts, but there's also a field of universities competing with each other to be good in different fields, trying to contribute to the public the results of research-based knowledge. And research has become more and more expensive, particularly in certain parts of the sciences, not the sciences in general, but some very big ticket parts of the sciences that require lots of plant to do their work. And the university has adjusted to this. The university has changed by really in two big ways. This huge growth of the cost of scientific research, which is paid for partly, not entirely, out of the tuition revenues of the university, is paid for secondly by trying to raise endowment income, which has its own impact on the way universities work, and which we often don't pay enough attention to because we look at the grants that we get from foundations and governments, which are usually a minority of the way in which the research gets paid. They're sort of paying a marginal extra. So thinking about the university materially should wake us up. But then if we think, well, what does that mean educationally? And we note the extent to which the arts and sciences have shrunk as a proportion of university, the extent to which the growth has come in professional schools and in independent research institutes of various kinds. And that may be fine. I'm not actually a critic saying, oh, that's bad entirely. What I'm saying is we haven't paid attention. We haven't really developed a strong knowledge base. Presidents and chancellors spend a lot of time dealing with this, but they spend their time dealing with the legislature, dealing with fundraising, doing things outside. They are very seldom able to really focus on the internal organization and educational policy of the university. So what we have is large, expensive institutions doing very important work and nobody really paying very much attention to how coherently and effectively this is happening and who benefits and who doesn't benefit from the way we've organized it.
And interestingly enough, the kind of education that results from this may emphasize research and move us away from a kind of humanistic, broad-based education that would train students to question values and think about new ways of doing things.
I think that's true. I think that can happen. I think that that's not unique to the humanities. That is, you could look at sciences and say, is this the accumulated truths of a bunch of past scientific research? Let's tell you what chemists found out over the last 200 years. Or is this the scientific research method, asking new questions, critical inquiry in the sciences? And we could teach science much more as critical inquiry and much less as technique. The same goes for social science and in, you know, humanities. So I think that we have lost some of that. We've lost it partly by emphasizing overwhelmingly the extent to which the undergraduate curriculum mirrors the disciplinary research fields. And there are counter trends. There are efforts to shift that, to have more interdisciplinary programs or to do other things. But nobody's really come up with a great new model. We have a model of the disciplines that is dominant that basically came into dominance at the beginning of the 20th century. It's not that old, in which the major is invented in reflection of the PhD research fields. And that has worked to a considerable extent, but it may need to be thought through in new ways.
Now, let's talk about the Social Science Research Council. How did it come into being, and what is the particular focus that you're trying to bring to this organization?
The SSRC was invented in 1923. It's one of the many products of Rockefeller family philanthropy, really just before what we now call the Rockefeller Foundation. It was sponsored by the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Trust. And the main drivers of it academically were faculty members from the University of Chicago and Columbia University, some others. And they identified a problem which is closely related to what I was just talking about and which we have not solved. They basically said, left to themselves, it looks like academic researchers will talk only to other academic researchers in ever smaller and smaller specialized fields, and that knowledge will be structured in terms of disciplines, and we will lose something more generally important. And so they set out to bridge these disciplinary discourses. They didn't say they're a bad thing, but they said we need interdisciplinary discourse. And in fact, the word interdisciplinary dates in part from that SSRC founding. They talked about the interdiscipline. And they wanted the discipline, but they wanted interdiscipline. And they began to back that in various ways, trying to organize more creative, more innovative intellectual work. One part of that was looking at social problems and social issues that needed to be seen from different sides. And that continues all the way through to the present day. So if that was an issue in 1923, it's an issue in 2009, where you say, the recent economic crisis. Is it just an issue of technical economics, or is it an issue that needs to be seen through the eyes of political science as you look at the possible building of new regulatory structures and the congressional politics of whether these are going to be passed, the presidential politics of what's being proposed? Is it a social issue that needs sociologists looking at the ways in which this affects or is affected by family life and its changes in America, or the structures of educational institutions, or the social organization of markets, and so forth and so on? So the need for different disciplinary perspectives in communication with each other, interdisciplinary discourse, is really important to tackling public problems. And so the SRC's early interest is the one that I want to try to bring to the foreground, bringing together the different perspectives that are necessary to get a well-rounded and adequate grasp of public issues that are before us.
Mm-hmm. And it is the case that since the founding, and I'm not blaming the social science, the social forces and the organizational forces that we've just talked about with regard to the universities have really cut the other way. I don't know if you saw this, but Joe Nye had a piece recently in the Washington Post criticizing the, along the same lines that you're doing, the way that social science has not become relevant to making policy with regard to international relations with which is the field he's interested in. And he quotes the editor of the American Political Science Review, who observed in the journal's centennial issue that if speaking truth to power and contributing directly to public dialogue about the merits and demerits of various courses of action were still numbered among the functions of the profession, one would not have known it from leafing through the leading journals. In the earlier period, there were many more articles talking about policy issues, and there are almost none in the recent period.
That's right. There are fewer. I think there's some resurgence, and I think that the Nye piece overstates the extent to which academic international relations is out of the political discussion. But the basic issue is a very important issue, the one he's raising, which is the tension between pursuing rigor by pursuing an internal critical discourse among scientists, which is genuinely valuable because they correct each other's errors and they push each other forward and knowledge gets better, and pursuing the usefulness of that knowledge by getting it out to other constituencies, by building relationships with other constituencies where it's not just a matter of dissemination. It's not just how do you get those people in Washington to read your APSR article. Mm-hmm. It's a question of building a relationship where the knowledge that those people in fields of practice have, who are working in politics or in diplomacy, can be put to work in the knowledge creation project, can come in and influence the university as well. It's a two-way street. It's not just dissemination. And I think we have been neglecting that. The SSRC has sometimes been part of the solution and sometimes part of the problem. I think part of the big issue is in the post-war period, the university sector grew enormously, and it became possible for people to talk mostly to each other in academic worlds and not reach out. They were very big worlds, political sciences. Very big profession, and economics is twice as big. And so you could have lots of internal discussion. That doesn't mean that nobody cares about those public issues. It may mean that people haven't developed the skills and the organizational mechanisms to connect very well and to value and reward that connecting. So they may think, well, it's really journalists who ought to do that. But it's not entirely journalists. And I don't mean here that what you want is every professor of political science or economics to become a blogger or every professor of political science and economics to try to write articles for The New Yorker. They're not going to be good at that for the most part. A few will be. Mm-hmm. What I mean is that collectively we need to build the connections to the journalists, so that the social scientist isn't just called after the whole story is written when the journalist needs a quote from somebody at a famous university.
Right.
But there is a two-way street where the social science is part of what's informing the critical thinking that goes into what the story is, as well as that quote. And that goes for policy. I think that another thing that's happened that has changed this is the growth of the think tank world, that there's a big buffer between academic researchers and policymakers. and it is think tanks, some of which are very partisan, some of which are not, some of which do pretty good research, some of which don't, most of which tailor their research much more closely to the issues and the timetables of the power structure in government than academics do. And they may draw on academic research or they may not, but what they do is stand between the academic researchers and the power makers. And I think that that's a problem for the ability of political science or any other field to speak truth to power.
Well, you know, when push comes to shove, I mean, is there a conflict between the long-term pursuit of an idea or a set of ideas, which is different than the time frame of the people making policy or the people who are activists?
Absolutely. And there is a conflict between not just the timetable, which is really a big issue. Right? If you ask a social scientist to work on an issue, they're going to take years, and it's going to be history by the time they finish, even if they're an economist or political scientist. But the economists, political scientists, sociologists, anthropologists have a huge reservoir of work they've already done, of knowledge that's accumulated, of intellectual capacity that doesn't get effectively deployed. So you can't do new profound research simply in response to a current public policy mandate and do it fast enough to have the congressional bill that comes forward next March be informed by it. Very often. Could happen, not often. Right? What you can do is find better ways of connecting the people who are these resources with the command of long-term knowledge to people who are working in shorter term in different time frames so that that knowledge can be effective. And I think, therefore, it's a matter of division of labor. So there's a real conflict. If you try to do all the things at once, you're like trying to be somebody who makes all the different parts of a complex industrial product. And you're going to make the car, and you're going to make the windshield, and you're going to make the tires, and you're going to make the engine, and it's not going to work. You need a division of labor. I think our problem is we don't have an effective division of labor. What we have is a bunch of specialists doing high quality work with very weak connections to what should be the rest of a division of labor.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's take an example, because what comes to my mind here is the problem of power and ideology. And let's take what Herb Bure calls the Dark Ages, the recent period of American foreign policy, and the invasion of Iraq, and now we're talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan. The social scientists and the area studies people have produced real knowledge about these places, and if they had been at the table and had been able to inform the discussion, then our policy outcomes would have been very different, mm-hmm. and we wouldn't be in the mess we're in. But the problem seems to be that power and ideology did not want that to happen. Is that a fair statement? And then what is the framework that would be involved in making a difference?
So there are different moments to policy in this, so take the war in Iraq or any other. The one disaster in the war in Iraq is terrible execution, terrible implementation of policies, and terrible consideration of potential unintended consequences. Right? So that set of failures at the level of the competence of the people carrying out the war could readily be corrected by bringing expertise in different ways, both academic and other kinds of expertise to it. So I think at that level, absolutely, getting different voices in, having people who really knew something about Iraq have a bigger voice in policy, having people who knew more about the Islamic world, having people who spoke Arabic, all of those things, but also having people who knew something about the likely aftermath of the conflict, right? So some of the problems are things like the looting of archaeological sites in Iraq. Well, there are people who know about that. So there is a big realm for direct impact of knowledge. The question of whether an administration is going to launch a preemptive war might not necessarily be corrected simply by having any particular group of academics around the table, because that's a question of their goals and what they're willing to sacrifice to achieve their goals. And so their willingness to sacrifice, the Bush administration's willingness to sacrifice some longstanding American values, including Republican values, to what they saw as a valid foreign policy agenda, which I don't agree about, is a decision that they were not necessarily going to be corrected by just having different academic expertise at the table, because their values are strong. And so I think that we need to acknowledge that there is a place for a real political process. So the question of whether the Bush administration's decisions reflected the well-informed will of the American people is a real question. And it's a real political question, not simply a political science question. But all the competence questions, we see this again with Obama. So you can look at the Obama presidency and ask whether he's doing just what you would like to see done in healthcare reform or any other big policy area. Mm-hmm. You can also look at just the considerable increase in the competence of the administrators and the extent to which they are informed by going to serious sources of knowledge. Sometimes that means bringing in academic experts. Sometimes it means that they were well-educated as students and really valuing how well-educated those current government officials were when they were students is a change. And a lot of our role as academics is to educate people well who are not going to be academics, not to imagine when we teach graduate courses, for example, that everybody has to grow up to be a professor to be a success. You know, actually being the head of the Africa desk at the State Department is a pretty big success and a pretty important job, and we should be figuring out how to give appropriate training for people who are going to do that.
Mm-hmm. You bring up Obama, and that's an interesting place to look, and also the present financial crisis. Mm-hmm. First, about Obama, when I was reading your book on China, it sort of obviously Obama isn't a revolution in the Chinese sense, but to what extent? Talk a little about the Obama phenomena and the extent to which it was a coming together of the kind of social forces and technology that you saw in China.
Right. And timing. Yeah. So Obama is a remarkable individual. He also is at the head of a sort of remarkable set of social changes and longer-term influences. And absent some of the problems that developed out of the Bush administration and some of the other problems of social change going on around us, this might not have happened. It's a huge change on several levels, just having a black president, having a president with the international side that he has is an enormous change. And we see this reflected around the world. Having somebody who wants to work in the way he's working is a change. Now, connect this back to China. What people think, well, this is not the gerontocracy. This is electing somebody young because he's competent, not old because he's connected. And that's a big change. That would be a big change in China. And it is something that is a change to some extent in the U.S. And it's happened before. But part of what's got people excited about Obama is that this seems to be a generational change and an orientation to competence, for want of a better word, in this. Now, at the same time, he's a great speech maker, and some people sort of deride that and say, oh, it's mere rhetoric. But it seems to me there's no such thing as mere rhetoric. Rhetoric is actually very central. Mm-hmm. The way in which a leader like President Obama is able to get people to think differently about issues around them, get them to evaluate those issues in terms of their stronger, higher ideals rather than only their immediate selfish interests, is an act of rhetoric. It's an act of framing. It's an act of using words to shape the way people think, but also to give people resources to think with. And so I think that the fact that Obama combines that nitty-gritty competence, which is valued not just individually but throughout his appointees, with this motivational capacity to get people to think differently about the very idea of the public, that they might actually care about what's happening in the public realm, is very important.
And I want to discuss that in one second. But first, I want to ask something. If we look back, well, let's say right now in the financial crisis, this is an opportunity in addition to being a disaster. Because
now, there's a Chinese line for you.
Yeah, that's right. But it creates, and you have suggested this in a piece you have on your blog or at the SRC website, namely it's an opportunity to rethink our values. But I'm curious, before we address that and this whole question of the public good, to what extent did the ideas about deregulation and about finance. Was that a reflection of running with ideas that weren't tested in the face of our recent history? Tell me something about that unraveling in your analysis.
I wouldn't quite those terms. So first off, it's the triumph of thinking in terms of private property, deregulation, the individual is natural and the community is artificial, is actually a triumph of spreading academic ideas. There are a bunch of serious intellectuals, Friedrich von Hayek, Milton Friedman, and so forth. There's also a very concerted movement over decades to try to make their ideas the sort of norm, the natural assumption, the default option for lots of people, so that it becomes the case that people think private property is normal. State action, that's a weird intervention, rather than what I think is more true, which is that these have always been linked. And, the operation of the mint, the operation of a whole, the military, the road building system, that the range of ways in which the private capitalist era has depended on public exercise of power, that it's not just episodic inventions, it's normal. Well, why do we think that the private is so dominant? We think one-sidedly. This movement to encourage thinking one-sidedly had financial backers, the Olin Foundation or others. It had serious intellectuals with really smart work. I mean, Milton Friedman's no dupe. It's not that somehow bad ideas were just put forward. It's that some very smart thinking was taken one-sidedly as though it's the whole truth and you don't need to examine it critically. You can just accept it as ideology. So by the time you get through to 2008 and the financial crisis, you've got a lot of people committed as unquestioned ideology to the view that it is always bad to have an intrusive government action like regulating, like saying something like, let's demand that every hedge fund be transparent in its operations. Let's dictate that firms explain what they're doing clearly so that their investors, let alone the public, can understand that and so the regulators can understand that. So even very basic things get rejected. And so my take on that is it's not that the ideas are necessarily all bad, that the idea is embodied in that work. It's that any set of ideas taken completely one-sidedly and turned into an unquestioned ideology is a vulnerability. And to avoid that vulnerability, you need to listen to other ideas, you need to have critical exchange back and forth, you need to avoid complete orthodoxies, invite heterodoxies, and have a discussion. And we failed to do that. So what we really did from the late 70s through to the last decade is block that discussion, build that unquestioned orthodoxy, make a few ideas just shibboleths that you just had to say, so that saying, I believe in freedom of individual enterprise and a deregulated market was like wearing a flag pin on your lapel. It was just a symbol that you had to articulate if you were a politician. But then it extended through organizations and institutions. It wasn't just ideas. Mm-hmm. It had material form in the way in which the supposed regulatory system was both captured by the industry and cut back. And versions of the same thing happen in other fields, big pharma and drug testing and all sorts of other arenas. So I think that we became inarticulate about the public as we became very articulate one-sidedly about the private. And the imbalance is something that we need to correct. And we have resources in our intellectual work to correct, but we haven't put those nearly as effectively to use.
So in thinking more about the public good, thinking more about public space, consolidating, we've elected a president who clearly can read and understand and take action. You've already suggested that the level of competency he's bringing to Washington through the education of people over here. So in a way, the alternative was incubating even during this period where we ran too far with one set of ideas. But the question becomes, given what your vision is at the Social Science Research Council. What beyond that would you like to see? How can social science contribute? And here I'm not just talking about the better way to deliver health, but rather the philosophical underpinnings which you're suggesting, which is, well, what is the public good? Why is it important? And so on.
Well, I think it's crucial to examine those questions of what is the public good, and what do different kind of answers to the question look like. So if you start with the idea that the public good is a set of virtues, a more or less Aristotelian idea, and you recast it through the Renaissance, but you think in terms of what it is to be good in public, then you're thinking in a different way from the idea of a calculable set of benefits, the goods that we can accumulate that might be distributed publicly. Or again, if you think about an issue, say affirmative action in universities, and you say, well, here's a public policy, what's the public good? Much of the discussion about that proceeds as though the public good is merely the sum total of a bunch of private benefits. Oh, well, who gets the chance at a better job because they got a university education at an elite university, right? An important question. But we forget that there's another kind of question, like, why do we actually have public universities in the first place? What do we think they can do in society by building an educated citizenry, by connecting people from different communities to each other? One of the reasons a university like Berkeley exists is, in fact, to build connections among a range of different students from different parts of the state, different parts of the world, from different ethnic groups, different religions, right? Another reason is to educate those students so that they can deliver good in public, not just so that they can make more money, right? So that we need to think in those ways. And so I agree very much that we need to have an inquiry at the level of basic values that reshapes this. Let me put that in terms of social science another way. I think we've often kind of tried to offload that inquiry to others and say, well, in philosophy or religion or someplace they're doing that. We're just worrying about the technical apparatus that puts certain policies into effect. And so we're going to stick to the analysis of voting behavior, not the question of what are the values behind how people vote. Well, I think we can't really be fully effective if we have too strong a division. These are distinct. We need to be clear about that. But we, the social scientists, need to think about that. When you take a position like there should be a deregulated market because it would be more efficient for individual capital accumulation, you are actually embedding values in that empirical statement. And you need to be able to see that that's going on and be clear about it. So I think that's a problem for us. But I think what I said earlier is also a problem, that we need to connect. We need to see that the economic crisis isn't just narrowly technical. It's not a matter of getting people to write better algorithms. We can see, well, it's kind of stupid to have algorithms that assume unlimited liquidity in financial markets because there's never unlimited liquidity. And look what happens when there's a liquidity crisis. Yes, you should, correct and improve on the algorithms. That alone won't do it. Right? You have to connect that to politics. You have to connect that to the idea of a participatory society and saying, are these approaches to economic technologies increasing social participation, the ability of the public to understand and participate in what's going on, or decreasing it, putting it in a narrower and narrower hand of experts who themselves may not even fully understand these financial products? And so those are animating questions for the social sciences. And I think, social scientists have been animated sometimes by these sorts of big questions, and sometimes they've been pulled more towards the pursuit of, reliability of narrower explanations, or explaining another 1% of variance in a model, and have neglected some of the bigger questions. And so we need to balance that.
So how would you advise a student who wants to be a social scientist to prepare for the future, given our discussion and your writing about the university, in the sense that disciplines, the university, can be on trajectories that take them elsewhere?
Right. Well, certain kinds of disciplinary training are great places to acquire technical skills. Like, economics has developed enormously powerful tools. They're very impressive. it would be nice to have the people who had those tools also have historical perspective, also have substantive international knowledge. And there's no intrinsic contradiction between knowing about different parts of the world and having those tools. Being able to think, in fact, about different parts of the world may be an asset as you begin to think, oh, it's true that there are certain mathematicizable laws about market or investment phenomena. It's also true that there's a real world that looks somewhat substantively different when you sit in Shanghai and when you sit in New Delhi and when you sit in Moscow, and that we need to take that seriously into account in thinking about all of this. And combine the use of those more abstract tools with that concrete knowledge, comparative, historical, cultural, as well as narrowly economic, political, as well as narrowly economic. So I would suggest that a student going into this needs to get a pretty broad education. And if we in the universities are very serious about the liberal arts, which I actually think, frankly, we aren't. I think, frankly, we haven't been for decades, and we've just been mouthing the slogan. But if we were to get serious about it, we would say that a good undergraduate education is going to prepare you effectively with some of that breadth and an appreciation for it, which you will sustain as you acquire more specific sets of tools, whether to become an academic specialist or a practical actor. Unfortunately, I think that the advancement in our world is so tied to the idea of having created something new, either a new tool or new knowledge with a new tool, that we are in a position where we find it hard to adequately value in our academic careers the work that it would take to be really good at that kind of strong educational mission.
And finally, I think a very important point you're making is that you have to be cognizant of, touched by, thinking about the social change around you.
Yes, social change and the variety of social worlds around you. And so the you spoke of nationalism earlier. You have to think about the ways in which the current crisis may be producing a new round of nationalist self-assertions, protectionist policies, as distinct from the kind of globalization of the last few years. But then you have to also think critically about each side. If you get that far, then you have to say, well, when is that nationalism good and when is it bad? When is it part of a developmental policy that might actually mobilize a population effectively for collective development? When is it part of a xenophobic, exclusionary policy that's going to lead to a conflict? And you have to do the same for globalization. You have to say, when is this a matter of actually promoting mutual understanding, collaboration, the greater good among people's world? When is it a matter of investing that is going to help business and not necessarily help people? Because lots of the globalization doesn't just happen. It's not a force of nature. It's a matter of like, well, we're going to invest in putting in fiber optics. And when we invest in putting in a global fiber optics network, it will make it possible to have call centers in India. And then that will have impacts on jobs in the United States and jobs elsewhere, and right, that these are active decisions that get made, and we are uncritical if we look at that as though it's just a natural process called globalization. And so once you look at both of those and start thinking critically, right, then you have a whole series of new questions for academic research. You didn't stop being a social scientist. You got challenged to go out there and do better social science.
Well, on that note, Craig, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come to the campus to participate in the Breslauer seminar and to be on our program. Thank you.
Great.
And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.